I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim and Godette. It's Idaho Matters. How big is an asteroid? It's not like you can just run out with a tape measure and figure that out. Turns out, if you can find it and you know when it might pass in front of a star, it's really not that hard to do. And a lot of students and citizen scientists like to do it. Chris Anderson is the coordinator at the Centennial Observatory at the Harrett Center for Arts and Sciences at the College of Southern Idaho. He's been trying to find and measure asteroids for, I think, more than 10 years, and he's going to talk about his research Friday night at Boise State's First Friday Astronomy. His talk is called In the Shadows of Asteroids, Stellar Occultations, Observations at the College of Southern Idaho. Man, that's hard to say. Chris, that is really hard to say. It's occultations. Am I doing that right?
That's right. The root word being occult. And of course, when you think occult, you think of like mystic arts and things like that. It really comes from the word hidden, meaning hidden, because, you know, there was a time when if you practice the occult arts, you better hide or you're going to be in big trouble. So this is the fact that a asteroid is hiding a star temporarily.
I like that. And it's not, you're not doing devil worship. This is, this is science.
Magic involved.
Okay, let's get really basic. What is an asteroid?
So asteroids are basically these lumpy hunks of rock that mostly orbit in between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. There are some other families found throughout the solar system, but that's where the main belt is, as we mostly know. And, you know, for the most part, Hollywood gets it right. When you see asteroids in the movies, they're just like what they look like. They're these kind of lumpy potato-like hunks of rock. What they typically get wrong, however, is how crowded they are. In our solar system, they're not nearly as close to one another as you're going to see during a Star Wars movie, for example.
That's good to know. That's good to know. And you mentioned lumpy. They're not round for the most part. I mean, you can find a round one, but, you know, they're all kinds of shapes.
Right. They basically don't have enough gravity to squeeze themselves into a spherical shape. And so trying to determine that shape is a very tricky thing to do. Even our most powerful telescopes simply can't zoom in enough to see them as anything but a speck of light. In fact, the word asteroid means star-like, because when they were first discovered, that's what they appeared like in a telescope, was just like a star, except unlike stars, they would move throughout the star field from night to night.
So they're far away. How do you figure out how big they are? And this is the trick. This is the occultation part. Yep.
So even if we don't know their size very well, we can determine their orbits pretty straightforwardly. It only takes three observations over a span of time to be able to determine, you know, predict in the future where an asteroid's going to go. And of course, there's always some uncertainty there, but we can say pretty well we know where it's going to be headed in the future. And so for a given location on the Earth, you can predict typically about 2 months out if a given asteroid is going to pass directly between you and a star. So then all you have to do is record it on video with your telescope. And when the asteroid gets in front of that star, the star just winks out. And I mean, it happens in an instant because the stars are so far away, they're basically like point sources as well. And then a few seconds later, the star comes right back. And then by knowing how long the star was gone, by knowing how far away the asteroid is and how fast it's moving through space, you've just made one measurement across that asteroid, what we call a chord, C-H-O-R-D. And that gives us a minimum size. If there's only one person doing it, that gives us the minimum size of the asteroid. But if we have several people on the Earth in different locations, then each one of them is mapping their own portion of that asteroid's shadow cast on the Earth. And then we can start to get an idea of what its size and shape is.
That is really cool. And you make this sound fairly easy, but it isn't like every time you go looking for one, it's there. This is sort of hit
and
miss.
In fact, you know, the very fact that you can go out and look into a starry sky and not see stars like regularly winking in and out tells you that these things are not all that common. In fact, I can literally think of only two times in my career that I know of a star that was a naked eye bright star that people were able to see blocked by an asteroid. So on the one hand, they're fairly rare. On the other hand, there are hundreds of thousands of asteroids out there. And so depending on your equipment, depending on how faint of a star you're able to pick up on your video, you can do quite a few of these. I'm typically in three or four times a week doing asteroid occultation measurements. Now, the other side of that is we know their orbits pretty well, but we don't know them with infinite precision. So there's always a probability associated with a given prediction of how likely is it that the asteroid shadow will actually pass directly over you. But because of that, that means when we make one of these measurements, we also help to refine the orbit of the asteroid too.
Well, how many have you tried to see, and how many have you seen?
Well, so my success rate is about 1 in 9. And in 10 years, almost 10 years, I think I'm up to about 115 positives. So you can do the math and just multiply that by 9, and that's how many attempts I've made. Now, admittedly, like I say, I do a lot of these somewhat low probability events just because my telescope here at the observatory, well, it's not my telescope, I just run it. My telescope I use it here at the observatory is decidedly not portable. So it's sitting in place. So there are a lot of events that are fairly low probability. There might be a 2 or 3% chance that the shadow actually passes over us. Well, if it's a 2%er, that means I have to do 50 of those before there's a reasonably good chance that one of them will be a positive. So we play the long game in that sense. We do lots and lots of observations, hoping to catch some of these low probability ones. But then there's also the 100%ers that we get from time to time as well.
Well, and as you said, negatives can be a good thing because you're gaining more information even if you don't see it.
Absolutely right. If you've got multiple people observing an asteroid occultation and some of them get positives and others don't, the ones who don't then tell us where the asteroid wasn't. So that also helps us to refine its shape by knowing, hey, it's not extending this far in a particular direction. And that's often a big deal because these asteroids can often be rather elongated. There are some in fact, there's even one called Cleopatra with a K that's called the dogbone asteroid because it's so elongated. It almost has the shape like a dog bone.
We're speaking with Chris Anderson, the observatory coordinator at the College of Southern Idaho. He's going to be speaking tomorrow night at Boise State's First Friday Astronomy about measuring asteroids. So, why do we want to know this information? Why do we care how big an asteroid is way out in space somewhere? How does that affect us Earthlings?
Well, that's a great question. And if you think about the history of exploring our solar system, right, it began with just the earliest humans before telescopes noticing that there were points in the sky that moved around. We called them planets, that meant wanderers. And then as telescopes were invented, we began to discover more planets and eventually the asteroids. And then in the space age arrived, we started sending probes out into space to fly by the planets, to sometimes orbit the planets, sometimes land on them. And now we've done that with all the major planets for the most part. So what's next? Well, what's next is the next largest bodies we have, and those are the asteroids. So it's just kind of a logical progression of trying to expand our knowledge of our solar system more and more. And to give you an idea, on a daily basis, there's typically between 1 and 2 asteroids that are discovered almost every single day. I
Wow.
come into work every day and I get a report on my email from what's called the Minor Planet Center over in Harvard. And they reported, like I say, anywhere between a dozen and 2 dozen new asteroids, previously unknown asteroids, every single day. And so we know almost nothing about them when we first discover them. And then it's just our goal to try to expand our knowledge, know more and more about their size, their shape, their orbits. And that helps us to kind of figure out how the solar system got to be the way it is. These are kind of the leftover debris from when the planets formed. And so they kind of represent a sampling of the early solar system that hasn't changed very much since those early days. And so the more we know about them, the more of a clue we get of how our planets got to be the way they are today, including Earth.
And you get a lot of your students involved, in measuring asteroids.
Yeah, one of the really nice things about this versus other types of astronomical research is that it doesn't require you to be in the observatory for an entire night. Right. So if you were, say, studying a galaxy and you wanted to measure its redshift, you'd be taking a spectrum of it. And often you have to spend hours collecting enough light to do that. Well, these observations, I can walk in the door, I can power up the equipment, I can take the observation and power everything down and be out the door sometimes in less than an hour. And that really works well for students who don't want to have to pull all-nighters to participate in astronomical research. The downside, of course, is that these things happen at any hour of the night. So I might be in here at 3:42 a.m. on a Tuesday morning sometimes to catch a particular asteroid. So that's the downside of it. But there's a fair number of students for which being up in the middle of the night doesn't seem to be that big of a deal. So
Yes, I remember that. How much fun is it to see that light from a star dip and know that you have actually seen an asteroid?
on the one hand, you describe to people what you're doing. You say, well, I'm looking at a computer monitor. Or a TV monitor, and there's a bunch of dots on it, and one of those dots is, they're all stars, and then one of those dots will all of a sudden just disappear for a few seconds and then come back, which sounds mundane, but then when you think about what's really happening there, an invisible asteroid, one you can't even see with a telescope, just got in front of that star, and it was there because we can predict these things well enough in advance to know that this little hunk of rock, maybe no more than a few miles wide, happened to be passing just in the right place to cover up that one particular star at that one particular moment. And it's just kind of cool that you're getting sort of a glimpse into the celestial clockworks, if you will, seeing how the gears turn and seeing it be happen before your eyes.
Well, it sounds like great fun. And anybody can do this? I mean, citizens, scientists can do this?
Absolutely. We back in 2022, I believe it was, our observatory contributed roughly 2% of all the asteroid occultations that were observed worldwide.
Nice.
But there are some amateurs who leave us in their dust because they are willing to drive to get to be in the path of the asteroid, and they can get, dozens in a year. I typically, if I'm getting around a dozen to two dozen in a year, I'm doing well. But there are some people that, like I say, they leave me far behind because they're willing to go drive a few miles to get into an asteroid shadow. And even with much more modest equipment than I have, they can get a lot of good results. We've all heard of citizen science a lot of times. It's, sitting on a computer and looking through data sets and things like that. But the nice thing about this is it's like the next level up from citizen science. It's really kind of like one step short of professional astronomy, in the sense that often when we get good results, it's not uncommon that we'll be listed as co-authors on the paper that's written about these particular objects that we've caught an occultation of and helped us learn more about.
Wow. We've been speaking with Chris Anderson, the coordinator at the Centennial Observatory at the Harrod Center for Arts and Science at the College of Southern Idaho. He'll be speaking tomorrow night at the Boise State Physics Department First Friday Astronomy. His talk is called In the Shadow of Asteroids, Stellar Occultation Observations at the College of Southern Idaho. The talk starts at 7:30 at the Liberal Arts Building at Boise State. Chris, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Samantha Wright. We'll see you tomorrow.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.